Welcome to a new episode of the Film at Lincoln Center podcast. This week, we're excited to present two conversations. The first, from the closing night selection of new director's new films, Theta Hamill's Stress Positions, and the second, from a current selection of the 61st New York Film Festival, Joanna Arnau's The Feeling That the Time for Doing Something Has Passed, which will be opening at FLC next Friday, April 26th. Get tickets now at filmlink.org/feeling. The bewilderment of the early days of COVID is given a manic queer twist in Stress Positions. Theta Hamill's brilliantly discombobulating comedy is set in Brooklyn in the summer of 2020, and their cinematic approach is thrillingly unpredictable, both visually and sonically, alternating between volleys of dialogue and meditative journeys into her character's subjective states, while the heightened delirium of Hamill and Fahim Ali's script evokes the hapless rules of engagement and the ever-shifting borders of queer politics. Enjoy the following conversation with director Theta Hamill, co-writer and co-star Fahim Ali, and lead actor John Early, moderated by New Directors New Film Selection Committee member Madeline Whittle. Stress Positions is in select theaters now.
Director, writer, star Theta Hamill. Co-writer and co-star Fahim Ali. And star of the show, John Early. I am so starstruck to be talking to all of you right now. So thank you all for the film. I'm going to dive right in.
We're starstruck to be here. It's very, very exciting.
This is, I think, couldn't have asked for a better closing night note to round out this festival on. So thank you all. To get right into it, I wonder if you could speak a little bit about where this film came from. It it's a story of community and of sort of a found family, maybe a dysfunctional found family, but family nonetheless. And it was I know that you all knew each other prior to embarking on this project, and so in a sense, it seems like a film that was born out of community or existing relationships. Could you just speak a little bit about where the film came from, how you embarked on this collaboration, and just sort of set the stage that way?
Sure. I've known John for a long time. As long as I've been basically an adult, I've known John. And I knew that John would have easy access to this character. Like, you would find it very, very easy. And because the original idea was just this character of Terry Goon, a sort of like buffoon who really, really valued these very basic domestic things that he just can't do for some reason, but like takes it very, very seriously. Like, as not somebody who goes, oh, that's just the way I am. You know, I can't cook. I can't throw a party. I don't. Nobody likes me. That's just the way I am. It's like, this is the worst thing that could have ever happened. And I've seen John play a variety of that kind of person, like,
and
over the years.
In real life, I think a little bit too.
No, in real life, John can cook exquisitely.
I oversalt.
But the original idea was just that character surrounded by his opposites. So Bahlul being the sort of main opposite, but everybody is opposed or paralleled to him in some way, and so it got very complicated very quickly, and stayed complicated all throughout the writing, all throughout the shooting, and then all throughout the editing, right up until the end, when it really folded down and became, I think, more about Bahlul and his mother, basically, and this quest for a surrogate mother. And everybody is found to be unsuitable in some way or another, and so that's the evolution of the idea, I guess.
And you and Fahim collaborated on developing the story. The story is in itself so intricate and so sort of the structure of this narrative that you're weaving is so multifaceted, and it's so, you know, alternately serious and hilarious and physical comedy, farce, commentary on sociopolitical realities, a period film about Brooklyn 2020 in the midst of COVID. How did you, could you speak a bit about that, the collaboration of developing this story, developing these characters, and what, how you juggled all of these sort of conflicting or potentially conflicting tones and bringing them together?
Yeah, I mean, we can, as soon as the idea of that character, of Bahlul, like, came into it, Fahim happened to be in the room, and I just sort of shouted across the room, what do I do here? Like,
the script originally
how can they be related?
Started as a 15-page script for John's birthday. And the As a birthday present. And then the characters of Bahlul and Abigail were in there, and we had a series of conversations about how to build out those characters, their hopes, their dreams, coming from opposite sides. I think Abigail is on a quest for salvation through maybe spiritual tourism, and whereas Bahlul is coming from the other side, trying to find his identity and thinking that that identity might come from a source of inspiration being his uncle in New York, and a way to find his identity through this kind of interaction with that uncle.
Yeah, the voiceover is a free, a source of freedom right up until the very end. So like the crafting of that voiceover, the original, like the draft in the original script was not satisfactory, I don't think, especially when we were putting the movie together. And what Kaher Harhash, who plays Bahlul, was giving didn't match the backstory that had been written up there. So there was midway through the edit this feeling that we had to tweak it, and that's really, I feel like, where we had these conversations about what a gay uncle might mean to a sort of queer kid in that position, and how that disenchantment might take place. You know, the hope and then the disenchantment, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I feel like the film is everyone in the film is orbiting around Terry, the character of Terry Goon, and he's sort of this gravitational center of the film. And I think this character is very much in dialogue, John, with other characters that you have embodied and given life to, but you're doing something different with Terry, and I think you're given the space to explore a little bit more of a full person in all his complexity. And I'm curious, you know, bearing in mind that Bahlul was kind of the fulcrum, the narrative fulcrum, this character of Terry. How did you build him? How did you construct him as a, you know, between the three of you?
I'll take that. I think the very first thing that I wrote in my little notebook, which I think I filled about half a page of total, but we had lots of conversations about it. But I think the very first thing I wrote was, I'm still with her. And then the next thing was something like, everyone has a fucking septum piercing now.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, we thought a lot about Terry's being kind of a gay millennial Tony Soprano. you know, the beginning of The Sopranos, he's talking about, you know, what happened to John Wayne, you know? And I think... you know, Terry has just aged out of his sexual type, just aged out. He probably aged out a few years before. He was maybe at one point a kind of milk-fed
aged out
twink.
Of Leo's sexual
Leo's type.
Yeah.
Leo
changed type.
Yes. And so I think he's feeling particularly raw at the top of the movie. We talked specifically, I think his gay identity, which had a lot of cultural cachet for him at some point in his life, and in the culture... in the 2010s, maybe, its cachet is waning, and he's feeling very resentful of the rapidly changing world around him. That's where we started with him. But I don't know. I mean, generally, what you're—I think you know—Theta has always, as my friend and collaborator in various ways, she's always taken the kind of blunt, clownish thing I do on my own, in my own work, or in my daily life, and kind of teases out something deeper, or teases out like some sort of critique in it, you know. And so that was the very, I think that was why this was a birthday gift in some ways. It was like her taking what I do and putting it in something deeper and richer.
I love the Tony Soprano comparison. And I think it gets to a quality of this film that's so special, which is this kind of, much like The Sopranos, it is constantly this balancing act between very dark, sort of serious subject matter, maybe sort of epitomized in Terry's worldview. Terry's a person who takes the world very seriously. But it's a hilarious film, and it's a film that manages to find exactly what's funny about a serious worldview and about these very serious topics. And I'm curious about your approach. Again, these questions I'm asking kind of all of you, just seeing the film as just an expression of some kind of collective mentality, but could you speak a little bit about balancing those forces of kind of like very serious, very, you know, ultimately unironic observations about the world that we're living in, delivered through this tremendous comedy of manners?
I think that Terry's pathos wouldn't seem as sad if he wasn't funny, because he's not tragic except as a funny kind of, you know what I mean, like a sort of pathetic guy. But in terms of juggling the tones, this is a I could answer by saying that those are two things that you see side by side kind of constantly in the culture. In my feeling now is that there is always something horrible and something deeply stupid like happening simultaneously or right adjacent to each other. And like that was very much like the experience of Trump, for example. It was like, it was screwy and evil at the same time. That's one approach to it. But the real honest answer is like, I am compelled to be funny, or try to be funny, like it's a compulsion, I guess. And then I feel
often when you're being serious,
I feel yeah,
you know.
And I feel, but I do. I feel I'm haunted by serious things, I guess. And so the balancing of those two things was a very difficult thing to do in the edit, because one could very easily overtake the other one. Like it was so, there were so many bad versions where they didn't kind of quite balance out. But the I feel like I didn't give quite a satisfactory answer, but is there any?
Well, I think the characters are trying to express some truth about the world, or trying to express how they feel about the world, by trying to show solidarity or love and affection, but doing so in such a clumsy way. And that comes off in a very comedic manner, but also you can see the sadness of their desire not being fulfilled in the way that they want.
I think it's like in like a satire that you can, if somebody is in love with somebody else and they go, "I love you," and their love is a joke, then that is a sort of a bitter thing. And that's not really true in this case. There are people, they have a deep need that maybe it's love or just like companionship, or maybe it's even to feel like they're doing good in the world, and they can't do it any more than Terry can cook or stand up without knocking something over. Like they can't do it, but the need is sincere. So I guess that's where it sort of comes from.
Yeah, I think a lot of Theta's work, if you look at Nymphowars...
please don't.
Sorry.
Please don't.
Please do. It does have a kind of beautiful, like... Theta's, like, among many things, a Foley master.
I'm not a Foley. No, I'm a good sound designer.
Okay, you're good.
Foley is when you walk on the... You get the shoes on your hands and you go clomp, clomp, clomp. I'm terrible at that. So I can't remember the sequence of steps.
You respect Foley enough to know that you're terrible.
I respect the art of the Foley.
But that's why I was so excited about this, was it wasn't... There's something very, I think... I mean, there are, like, true... unapologetic pratfalls, and there's banana peels, and a sound design that sometimes, you know, it like highlights the kind of screwball-y things in the movie, you know. And I know we over the years have been very sick of this kind of past maybe 15 years. There's a lot of work that has been obsessed with like the blend of drama and comedy, the dramedy, you know, and what I was so excited when I read the script was that there was hard comedy and then like dead serious ideas, and that to me is what's like one of the most ambitious things about it. It's like it's just putting those things right next to each other and refusing to let them like dissolve into just nothing or into vibe or something.
I love that you connect it with the sound design and engineering, because Theta, in addition to being a podcaster, you are a sound, or you had your start as a sound engineer, or
sort of. I never worked. I mean, I got a degree that I never quite used the way I was supposed to, but I do have sound experience, and it has come in very handy in every stage of like filmmaking.
And if you paid attention to the credits, you caught that there was original music that you composed that is very much part of the sonic fabric of the film, I think. And so I'm curious, like the points that John was making about this sort of headbutting of comedy and seriousness, I think I'm curious formally, and particularly with an attention to sound, how you drew that out in the sort of texture of the film and what you were going for in terms of like the effects that you were in beyond script, beyond performance. Like, how did you frame this story sort of tonally?
I think I wanted it to feel like a very loud thing could happen at any moment. Like that, so... I guess there is, in order to have that contrast, like there has to be sort of moments of suspension it's like the avoidance of vibe isn't just out of a hatred of vibe. It's like that dynamic contrast in the sound can help to have that weird explosive moment, and it's always happening. Everything is always maybe a little bit too loud when John like runs into things or when the mirror falls on him. But then as far as the music is concerned, like the music is really where the moodiness comes from. The edit without the music I felt like very proud of myself. I was like, wow, we did it with no music. Wow, that's so cool. And then I got, I chickened out and put all this music in that actually, I think, helped bind it a little bit and was the most satisfying. It was definitely the most satisfying part of the whole process, because the kind of music that I've made that I've done nothing with, really, I've just done it, always had a weird wonky wobbly sound and then a sort of serene, melodic, poignant thing. And as soon as that entered into the mix, I could make sense. I could justify how the movie actually was feeling overall. I was like, "Oh, okay, the music is in microcosm the same thing, same blend."
And
I have nothing. I was.
I would say rolling it back to the level of to the shoot. You're all performing in this film. You're all. Not only participants in crafting the story, but in enacting the story, and in sort of this very intricate ensemble chemistry that you have going is what creates the texture of the film. And could you just speak a little bit about your approach to these characters and to working together as an ensemble, as this very fragmented ensemble, but nonetheless one that is coherent?
Well, initially, I had no intention of playing the character Ronald.
Yeah.
When it was written, we didn't know who would play this, and Theta had casted a few people.
I hadn't cast them. I
you were interviewing, auditioned a few people. And wasn't satisfied, and asked me multiple times to play the role, which I constantly refused. Finally, I decided maybe I should rise to the challenge. And most of what you see on screen is just coaching from John. Honestly,
gave really good coaching.
Yeah, everything comes from John, and I was really grateful for the opportunity, and I learned a lot from it. So it was a good experience for me.
I mean, I should also say that, you know, there were gigantic dialogue scenes there that we, even with our tiny little budget, found some time to, or kind of made sure we had time to rehearse, which was so, so nice. I mean, I've said this a lot before, but I come from doing a lot of comedy where I'm expected to just improvise, you know, with two cameras, and there's just, it deflates the energy. It makes sets just so uninspired, you know? And this actually, because it was so dense and kind of theatrical and kind of like a little chamber piece, like we really, and especially because Kahir also had never acted, who plays Balul, and he, you know, he's an actual model. And you know, so we, the three of us with that birthday scene especially, we rehearsed those scenes a lot, and that was just so nice. I never, ever, ever get to do that. But Theta and I come from theater, and I think we value that.
I have to shout out your performance, Theta. You're hilarious.
That's nice. My producer, Brad Becker-Parton, who is on set and is here presently, told me that he was very surprised when he saw the first cut of the movie that I was even giving a performance in the first place. Because there was so little difference between how I was on set and how I was when the cameras were rolling. But I do think very homeopathically, subtly, there is a performance there. And it was a tremendous benefit to be distracted by all of the other things, you know, that were happening just outside the frame.
I found it very liberating.
Acting's always this weird afterthought for Theta, which is, it always, when Theta's acting, I'm like, oh, it's easy. You know what I mean?
It's easy because I wrote it for myself to be easy. Because it's easy. The most fun thing is to just lie. Everybody else has a much harder job. Like John has to be desperate. Ronald has to be like polite and do all of these things. And Carla just has to sit there and like baldly lie to everybody, which is so fun to just do confidently. I felt like I was writing to my strengths.
It's such a precise, the setting of the film is so precise, both like geographically, it's such a Brooklyn film, but it's also so specifically a pandemic era film, a 2020 film, in ways that are written into the script and the topics of conversation and Terry's anxieties, but also this, speaking to a particular cultural moment of the way that people are reckoning with wokeness or what have you. Could you speak about addressing that period from this remove of a few years and how you approached that distance?
Yeah, I think the really headline banner issues of that moment are sidelined in the movie. And it makes a lateral move into a domain that is a little bit less like ripped from the headlines, but the concerns are still the same. So the concerns are still generational antagonism, identity, like conflict of identity, and like issues of the world. Like so, the there is a repeated like binary of in the, not a binary that sounds so dumb the, but the, there is this idea repeated throughout the movie of the world. It's like the world is out there and then you are here, and the question is like, do you like where you are? Probably not, especially for Terry, but like I mean, does everybody like where they are at the moment in life? And you go, maybe not. Is there something better for me out there in the world? Can I encounter the world? Can I go out and have an authentic experience in the world without actually extracting something from it or trampling all over it or just being a mere tourist in the world? Do you know what I'm saying? And like, so the idea of this character who is stuck in place and very, very afraid to go out into the world for fear of either catching something or doing something wrong, that's how I feel, is like that situation is enhanced dramatically by having the COVID, this COVID premise. Because COVID or this virus is like the world. It's one of those moments where your awareness of the world is enhanced. Everyone in the world is in lockdown. The virus comes from the world. You know, it's not like one of those things that's happening over there. And then what it actually ends up doing is activating this person who would love, I think, actually to just stay at home, but now is a hero for staying at home. They're living their best life. They're being a great help.
And they have a moral. There's like a moral excuse for being like,
yeah,
you know, which was a very, very strange thing about COVID. There was already something in the air. Obviously, there was like a fear of each other that was already, you know, really boiling, and then COVID gave us this externalizing kind of thing. It's just about health. You know, this is just a moral, you know, it's like, so I think, and it's bizarre the way COVID, things about COVID don't seem to explore what is such an obvious metaphor, which I think is a strength of Theta's writing.
I think that the other thing that is worth saying is that the thing that we're like, it's hard to find a non-reactionary word to describe, like wokeness is such an unsatisfying word. It's like the politics of identity practiced by millennials on social media in the 2010s. At that moment, it's a, you could have an acronym maybe for it. But at that moment, there was a changing of the guard. That's what I remember, like going out onto the street for the protest movement. It was very clear. It's like, oh, a whole nother generation has come of age. And there is a weird brackish, like maybe a sort of personality clash in these gatherings. And you go, not only am I old, which I already knew that I was, but you know, it's like you're getting by on the fumes, then you go inside terrified of everything for 3 months. You come back out and you realize you've gotten very old, and there are all these new young people. And you can't expect their political discourse to be a direct continuation of whatever was going on with millennials in the 2010s. Those politics of identity are starting to wear a bit at this moment in time. I think that right now, especially, that it's already a totally different equation. So in the middle of all of that, Terry's politics are extremely anachronistic because they come from like 2011. They come from like, you know, right?
Christopher Hitchens reference in there.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like an ex-new atheist.
Gay marriage, newly legal.
What?
Gay marriage, newly legal.
Yeah, gay marriage, newly legal. This is the greatest victory. That is the end of history for Terry Gunn.
And yet history continues.
Yes.
I'm sorry to say that I'm getting the signal that we're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap it up. I'm so sorry, but thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Maddie.
In her unsparing, acerbically funny feature debut, Joanna Arnau stars as an emotionally detached young Brooklynite drifting through unremarkable days and nights. With her film, Arnau finds a core of poignant truth about the ways people search for those elusive, ever-shifting things like emotional happiness and sexual gratification, refusing to judge them while at the same time unafraid of presenting their flaws. Now please enjoy the conversation with director Joanna Arnau and select cast members of The Feeling That the Time for Doing Something Has Passed, moderated by NYFF 61 Currents programmer Tyler Wilson. And don't forget, The Feeling That the Time for Doing Something Has Passed opens at FLC on April 26th. Get tickets at filmlink.org/feeling.
Thanks, Joanna. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I guess we lost a few of the cast members. but yeah, this row is almost as long as the title. Can I ask you about the title?
Yes, but first, can I give kind of a speech?
Of course, please. Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you again for having us. And because it's our first hometown screening, I just wanted to take a minute to thank all the amazing cast and crew here and in the audience. I'm going to read their names. And please, I think, hold a pause until the end because it's a long, nice list. Thank you, producers Graham Swan and Pierce Maris, the wonderful cast on stage with me, Alicia Reiner, Parrish Bradley, and Peter Back, as well as Scott Cohen and Babak Tofty, who couldn't be here, cinematographer Bart Courtwright, production designer Grace Sloan, costume designer Nell Simon, hair and makeup artist Don Campbell, casting director Charlotte Arnoux, assistant director Corin Helene Gittimer, acting coach Essie Casey, sound designer Eli Cohn, associate producer Adam Kirsch, publicist Emma Myers, and Sierra Slaughter. Our cast, Michael Cyril Creighton, Ava Eisenson, Brian McCarthy, Jay and Leah Giampietro, Martha Shane, SJ Sun, Eleanor Pienta, Kaya Matisse, Josh Luxenberg, the amazing team at Magnolia, and all our fantastic cast and crew who couldn't be here tonight, and sorry if I forgot anyone, and especially our executive producers, Sean Baker, Adam Murels, and Robbie Murels. And lastly, the huge community of friends here who also helped me with on the film with locations, background, and so much more. I'm very grateful for you all to be making the film with me. Thank you so much. Thank you for letting me do the speech.
But yeah, the title. I know it's something we hear in the film. We hear a variation of it. But I'm just curious, this exchange that Anne has with Chris, was this a focal point for you early on in your writing? Was it a scene or a moment that you knew you needed to get to at some point in the film?
I don't think so, but I think at the same time that I thought of the idea for the scene and the dialogue, I thought that would be also a good idea for the title. But yeah, I guess I just thought in a film that kind of reflects on the way time passes in our lives and the patterns that, it seemed appropriate and that there was something, you know, I hoped humorous in the angstiness and length of it too, kind of making fun of itself a bit.
So can you maybe tell us how you did get started with this film?
I had an urge to write lots of very short scenes that drew on personal experience and was interested in kind of creating new, experimenting with vignette-based forms and kind of finding humor in the everyday dialogue of how people talk.
Well, yeah, can you say more about, what What excited you about, you know, this kind of restriction of working in the short film or short form, like vignette? I mean, obviously it lends itself, I think, pretty naturally to comedy. I think I've heard you actually liken it to single panel comics, but I think, like, it, taken together, how you sequence these vignettes, mapping them around, you know, Anne's professional, family, sexual relationships, I think it invites us to think about the, sort of the total a bit differently. It's especially as it, you know, relates to just how we experience our own or just navigating relationships and professional or like just power dynamics.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of why short scenes, I have been interested in finding like concise humor and pushing that further and kind of boiling things down as much as possible. And I was interested in making a film that kind of, I don't know, takes moments of our lives and jumbles them all up together and kind of creates an impressionistic experience of how we kind of go through our days. And, you know, sometimes, you know, things are wild and all mixed up together. And sometimes there's kind of a lull where we stay in one place for a while and kind of sink into it. So that was some of the thinking there.
So I assume you always knew you would play Anne?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so how did knowing that you would play the main character just help in your writing process? I mean, I know with your films, you often lean into sort of the auto-fictional mode and put yourself out there as a performer. I'm just curious, what freedoms did this afford you in the writing process and sort of where did that take you with your ideas that you wanted to explore with the feature?
I mean, I feel like I like to... You know, this film isn't autobiographical, but it draws on personal experience, and I consider it autofiction. And I like to kind of, you know, explore the comedy of sometimes darker themes such as like loneliness or difficulties of navigating relationships, using this kind of specific personal bent that I hope, you know, can resonate with others. And, you know, since it's a comedy, leave people feeling hopefully lighter about it, too.
Well, since we have some of the cast here, I'm wondering if maybe you can just talk about assembling the cast and just how you went about thinking just building out sort of the other ends of Anne's network in the film.
Yeah, well, would you guys all like to say how you came to be involved in the project?
Sure.
Yeah. Wow, this is fancy.
I'm trying to remember now. I got the script and I watched your shorts and I called Scott Cohen because I know Scott and I was like, are you really doing this? And as an actor, when you're asked to do like tiny movies with a director that you've never met before, you're like, is this, you know, you call another actor, that's what you do, that you know, and you're like, and he's like, yeah. And I was like, I really like her voice. I really like her voice. I really like what she's saying.
Artistic
here.
Voice, yes, not actual
artistic
voice.
I had not heard her actual voice yet. I really like her artistic voice. I really like what she's trying to say here. And I think it would be really fun. Are you doing, like, I'll do it if you do it. It was really one of those. And he's like, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do it. That's the like behind the scenes, why you come to the New York Film Festival, truth of why I did the movie. And I'm so glad I did, because watching it is such a spectacular experience.
Yeah, it was a lot more simple for me. So I auditioned, and Joanna allowed me to be a part of this project. So the normal actor, director, casting director process, and I'm up here. So I'm very happy and blessed. So yeah,
with the help of our wonderful casting director, Charlotte Arnoux.
And the noses are for sale as merch.
I was a huge fan of you, Joanna. before Pierce emailed me that I think you were interested in casting me. And so I was immediately like, oh my God, this is amazing. I'm in. And I think that's how it happened, right?
I think you were actually, you came by because we were finishing Actors.
Oh, was that one?
Like, yeah, you were like at a screening.
And did you
like,
say something in person?
I was like, hey, do you want to, you know,
oh,
we're
yeah,
doing
no,
this film.
No, you're right. It was in person. Yeah. You're right. But and it was, I was honored. I mean, you know, I feel like I saw, I Hate Myself smiley face before I even met you. And then I saw all your shorts, a couple of them here. And I was just a fan. So I felt like I was being, you know, being plucked into the Arno universe was like better. For me, that's my Marvel.
You agreed before we even sent you the scripts. I was like, yeah, I'll send you the script. He's like, yeah, yeah. Send the script.
It was immediate, yes.
Well, I'll just say a bit about how I found these great folks here. For Alicia's character, I was really interested in finding someone who was could provide kind of a comic contrast to my character. And I felt like just like seeing both of us together and your presence, like it really... I don't know. There's a tension there right off the bat. And
it was really hard to be mean to her, but I tried really hard.
And Parrish, I mean, your audition just blew us away. And like you just, I don't know, you had so much sort of joy and humor in that role. Like I wanted to kind of, I don't know, show someone who was just, like having a fun time with what
fun,
he was
yeah.
doing, yeah.
Yeah, he's just having a good time. That's all it was.
And yeah, and Peter, I knew when I wrote it that that's who I wanted for that. So yeah,
it's all the dialogue's directly based on Peter.
Please, I thought you said you wouldn't say that.
Well, Graham and Pierce, maybe could you comment on, I guess kind of more of a general question, but just comment on your experience just watching Joanna build this film, build her world, just kind of what kind of conversations was she having with you about this film early on?
Early on?
You were watching me?
Yeah,
were watching. We're always watching.
Yeah. On the security cameras at Nice Dissolve,
that's
I
true.
Know, yeah.
I don't know, you know, the it was always the biggest thing with the film, like I think when we were first putting it together was at first I thought it wouldn't be that hard because there wasn't anything like specifically complex. There weren't like these big complex scenes. There weren't like big production, you know, heavy things. But then I think we kind of quickly realized that there were just a lot of scenes. So I think there was a lot of discussion about how many of those scenes we should shoot and how many of those scenes needed their own locations. There were a lot of those discussions, but then I think, you know, there was like throughout the big thing I remember, because I was like Joanna and I went over the script a lot of times when we were approaching production, and I was always trying to get her to cut more because we didn't have enough money to shoot all the stuff that was in the script. And she kept saying like, okay, but I don't know what's going to really be funny until we shoot it. Like that, and it was really true because there were a bunch of scenes that are in the movie that I was, you know, trying to cut. Not a bunch, but there's several that and that she was right about, and there's several I was right about. That's it.
That's true.
This is why when Joanna's like sitting next to me, it's like because she's gonna elbow you because you're like you tried to cut that, you tried to get me to cut that, and they laughed.
But then I don't know. I mean, we just talk about everything. We just like there's a long WhatsApp chain that still goes regularly. So I don't know. I don't know what was your experience working with us, Joanna?
I thought Tyler is supposed to be asking the questions.
It's okay. It's a discussion.
I liked both of you. I still do.
We like you too. Thanks for having us on this.
Present tense.
Well, I'll open it up to the audience in a minute, but I do want to ask about the casting choice of working with your parents. I know they featured in another film of yours, I Hate Myself, Smiley Face, in a pretty surprising way. And I'm just wondering how you know did it take much convincing to get them to work with you again on a feature, and just what was that dynamic like?
No, not too much convincing. My mom volunteered, and we had done a camera test with her, and I just thought she was great. I had been curious about her, you know, screen presence because I thought she was an interesting person to watch from the documentary. And yeah, I guess I just liked working with a mix of first-time actors as well as seasoned actors. I felt like it, you know, lent the story more authenticity to see different styles and like in a film that has different neighborhoods and different textures. I just really wanted to kind of have it be a full tapestry.
Yeah. I do want to, I could just like talk a bit about comedy for a second, or just how you think about it throughout your filmmaking process. I mean, there's obvious verbal and physical comedy in this film, but also just the way the film is structured and just how you sequence the films. There are also these jokes that emerge just with the cut. And I'm just thinking about how your ideas about comedy sort of shifts at, like once you get to the editing stage of the film.
I mean, it was exciting to, you know, find new jokes with the edit. And, you know, we have these different storylines throughout the film with, you know, I want to include work and family along with the sexuality and relationships plot lines. And it was, I think exciting comically to underline the contrast of, you know, character wrestling with communication, power dynamics, and things along communication. And like sometimes underlining the contrast between those threads and sometimes underlining the similarities. So, yeah.
I guess going off what Graham was saying, how long was the film initially?
It wasn't a cut. It was just the first assembly of all the scenes that we shot without any sort of, you know, removal. It was 4 hours. It was...
Second film there.
It was a real rough choices were made to get it down to 88 minutes. And I definitely miss a lot of characters and storylines.
Okay. Any questions? Yep. There's a hand right there.
I was wondering if you could talk briefly about the fake or the contrived films within the films, a film, the experimental, and then the French piece. I really enjoyed those. I was just curious to hear a bit about how they existed.
They were inspired by certain films that I had seen, and with the ocean one, like I was kind of like hoping to set a new tone with that. I guess same with the French music film, to sort of use these real emotions that I had watching these films and create something new that could shift the film in a different way.
I was just wondering if you could speak to, were there any films that were, or filmmakers that were a big influence on you while you were working on this film?
Thanks, Jesse. I feel like one reference for me is always the work of Simon Leung, and especially how his long take, long shot style leaves the viewer room to experience a strange cinematic world in their own terms with and emphasize the comedy of things playing out in context. And our cinematographer Bart Courtwright worked with me to find those uncomfortable framings.
Similarly to the experimental film question, the show tune that you sing, that's not a piece from Les Mis, right? So I guess my question is that the music and the experimental piece, what is the line between creating your own universe and budget constraints for the licensing on those choices?
I can't, who's talking? Can you wave? Oh, okay, hi, sorry. Just didn't see you there. Yeah, the Harry Potter song is something that I wrote in high school. And I, it was supposed to be a different musical, and that was a budget constraint.
There were a couple of budget constraints.
So we had to cut it, and a good friend suggested, why don't you just put your Harry Potter song in? And I was like, what? That doesn't, would that make sense? Why would I just suddenly be singing a Harry Potter song? But it kind of, I think it sort of seems like it's Les Mis, and then maybe just slightly confuses people who are listening to the lyrics, but it's fine.
I thought it was in Les Mis.
We're trying to get it to chart, so please look up on Spotify and iTunes when you go home.
I'll repeat the question was about just the challenges directing yourself in the film.
It was kind of a mix of things, a wonderfully supportive team overall, you know, just getting an idea of how the scenes were going while I was in them. And I had two wonderful friends who were my acting coaches, Essie Casey, who's here, and Han Park, who isn't. And we had a rehearsal process before, and they would reflect back my performance to me and you know, discuss the different ways we had wanted to try it. And then I would also watch back takes, like maybe like one or two per scene to get a sense.
Okay, we have to wrap it up. But Joanna, everyone, thank you so much for this hilarious film.